This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Who would have thought we'd have access to the files of the Soviet Communist Party? Well, as of February, the archives of the Central Committee of the Communist Party are open. It's a goldmine for historians. My guest, William Taubman, was one of the first American scholars to take advantage of this access. He's writing a biography of former Prime Minister Nikita Khrushchev. He's also working with officials at the archives on designing its future use. Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. He's been to Russia several times in the past year. His most recent trip was in March. Before he shares his impressions of life in Moscow today, let's find out what it felt like to be in the archives.
It was a thrill. It felt as if it was a miracle. I not only was in at the headquarters of the former Central Committee of the Party, which is where the archives were located, I was not only in their reading room, but they took me into the vaults where the actual documents are located. They took me behind the scenes and showed me card files that they had as a kind of guide to the materials in the vaults. So in that sense, it was a tremendous thrill. And when I actually got the documents in my hand, or I was reading them on microfilm to see, for example, the protocols of a meeting of the party secretariat or of the party Politburo, to see Stalin's signature scrawled across a page or Khrushchev's signature, it was a real charge.
Now, why exactly were you invited in on this? It seems to me that the Russians might have wanted to examine these documents and ferret some out before letting anyone in the West read them.
Well, I think they're torn because on the one hand, you're right. They want to know what they have. They want to put them in order. They want to ration them out in return for various favors they may receive from the West. But on the other hand, despite the lavishness of the facilities, they're poor. The archives are a kind of microcosm of the whole country at this point, which contains these immense natural riches, but is dirt poor when it comes to hard currency. And so these archives are very anxious to begin arrangements with the West, which will bring them publicity, which will bring them goodwill, and will also bring them directly or indirectly money.
Well, you think people will be paying for access?
Well, not in so many words. What happens, for example, my mission in the Central Committee Archives was to help to organize a conference on the history of the Cold War. The American partner would be the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, and the Russian partner would be these very same Central Committee Archives. And the archives, as our partner, would stage the conference. They would provide the hall, they would provide the translation, they would declassify the documents, they would Xerox the documents, they would write some of the papers. And in return for absolutely legitimate services like this, there would be some compensation for them. And this is a very small arrangement. The papers have had stories here. I'm not really conversant with the details about huge deals in which millions of dollars are supposedly going to be paid to these archives for the right to microfilm their holdings. The Hoover Institution in California has supposedly signed an agreement like this with the Central Committee Archive.
So what are some of the most interesting documents you've found so far?
Well, I should say this, that I talked about what a thrill it is, what a miracle it is, but there's a downside to it as well. It turns out that not all the most interesting documents, and in fact, for my purposes as a biographer of Khrushchev, the most important documents, it turns out, are not there. They remain behind the walls of the Kremlin in the so-called presidential archive, materials have not been transferred to the archive I was in. And there, for example, the records of the Politburo of the party after 53, they're still there. The personal files of the most important personal papers, which include politically important materials of Stalin, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, are still there. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that even the marvelous materials that the archive does have, they've not all been declassified. It's not clear to me how many have been declassified. I think a fair number have. But you can still, the procedure is you look through the finding aids. You find the documents that interest you, you request them, And then they're either delivered to you or you're told they're not available yet because they haven't been declassified. And I was told that about a number of them. So there are obstacles. And by the time the day is done, although you're in this magical place, you're still wishing that you had more.
That said, what are some of the documents that you found that were of great interest?
Well, the kinds of things I tried to make a random sampling. So, for example, I ordered one day's protocols of the Secretariat of the Communist Party in the Central Committee Archive. And I was stunned to discover that this group of seven or eight top party leaders in one day decided upwards of 100 issues. And to see whether this was also true of the Politburo, I went over to the other party archive, the Central Party Archive, and ordered a day's worth of decisions of the Politburo from 1934. And here, they decided, on this one day, they decided 120 questions. You don't get, I hasten to add, you don't get the byplay, the dialogue. It doesn't say, Stalin said, so-and-so objected. You simply get a list of the topics considered and the decisions taken. And it comes to that kind of incredible number.
That would indicate to me that there wasn't a lot of freewheeling debate about each of these subjects.
To say the least. Well, I asked people I know, both in the archives and out, about this. What could explain this? How did they operate? And the answer was everything, or almost everything, was coordinated in advance. When an issue came up, it was given to the party leader in charge, whose job it was to prepare a decision. He then consulted with the relevant departments of the Central Committee and other government agencies and brought to the Politburo or the Secretariat a decision already made or already proposed. There was no sign of various options. You know, we can do this or we can do that. No sign of argument. And then I said, well, that's fine, but in a system, the leader of which is Joseph Stalin, surely the people who were preparing the decision wanted to know what he would think, lest they arrived at a Politburo meeting with a finalized decision only to be told he didn't like it. And they said, well, people knew pretty much what he wanted. That was one of the things that a good colleague of his or a bureaucrat had to know, because the cost of not knowing was conceivably as much as a bullet in the back of the head.
What else have you found there that is important to you?
Well, another thing I looked at was a file of documents that crossed Khrushchev's desk. I wanted to see what kinds of documents crossed his desk on an average day. And they had documents in this file from a particular, or list of documents from particular 2 months in 1954-55. And again, I was really surprised to see how many of them there were. There would be 20, 30, or 40 items which would hit his desk through this one channel. I assume there were other channels on any particular day. And in addition to the number of them, I was surprised to see how trivial many of them were. I remember one in which some elderly party member asked permission to attend classes at the higher party school. And he said in his petition that if this weren't convenient, then he would be willing to take this course as a correspondence course. One would think that an item like this could have been decided much farther down the hierarchy and didn't require the time of the leader of the USSR. But there it was on his desk, and his signature was scrawled across the document saying that he approved. I think, you know, this is not an earthshake. The item itself isn't earthshaking, but the revelation that the leaders of the Soviet Union spent so much time on trivia helps to understand why they made a mess in the end of what was really important.
What do you think is the problem? Do you think the leaders of the Soviet Union didn't know how to delegate?
Well, I think that's partly it. These are people who wanted to decide everything themselves, but it's certainly not just personality. It has to do with the nature of a political system, which is, in effect, one mammoth bureaucratic organization. Everybody in the country works for the state and the party. Everybody in the country is subordinate, in the end, to the same small group of party leaders or even the individual party leader. And in that kind of situation, the buck is passed up, as it is in any bureaucracy, But since the whole country is one huge bureaucracy, more bucks are passed at a faster pace.
If you're just joining us, my guest is William Taubman, professor of political science at Amherst College. He's also researching a biography of Khrushchev. And he is one of the few Americans who has so far taken advantage of the new access to the archives of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. He was last in the Soviet Union in March. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Soviet expert William Taubman is my guest. Do you kind of feel like you really ought to hurry up and take advantage of these open archives because maybe they won't be open for long?
Well, I do feel that. But on the other hand, I was there long enough to sort of case the joint and to discover, as I mentioned, that the most important materials for me are not yet available.
Right.
I think that somebody who was, let us say, working on a somewhat different subject, if I were working on a subject of how the Central Committee of the Party, through its various departments, controlled all aspects of Soviet life, then I would be in Moscow right now. Because, for example, as I read through the files of the culture department of the Central Committee, I came across reflections of the Pasternak affair. I didn't actually read the documents. I read the index to the documents, but it talked about how instructions had been sent to the Writers' Union for how to handle the awarding of the Nobel Prize to the poet Boris Pasternak. So that, in other words, somebody with a topic like that, somebody who's interested in the day-to-day control by the party of cultural life, of social life, of all aspects of Soviet life, should be on the plane right now, even though, as I also said earlier, there's no guarantee that those documents that I saw in the index will have already been declassified.
You know, historically in the Soviet Union, one of the problems has been revisionism, historical revisionism, and amnesia. When the leadership would change, the past would be rewritten, certain things would be officially forgotten. How much revisionism do you see happening now? How much amnesia do you see happening now with the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, two or three years ago, when Gorbachev was still in power, the history of the Soviet Union was the rage. That is to say, the newspapers and journals were filled with revisions of Soviet history based at that point not on access to documents, but simply reflecting the fact that people who had long memories could at last speak and write. Nowadays, interestingly enough, not that many people are consumed with history in the way they were two or three years ago. And I think the reason is partly the fact that the problems they face are so compelling day to day that they have no time and no energy and also no money. That is, many of the historians, like other smart people in the former Soviet Union, are trying to find themselves a place in a free market. They're looking around for jobs that will pay them more money than a slot as a historian for an institute. If you sit all day in the archive doing research for a book of history, you won't get paid very much. And the further fact is the book isn't even likely to be published because the publishers want these days to publish only bestsellers. And it turns out that the bestsellers are detective stories, mysteries of various kinds, romances, and pornography.
This sounds familiar.
So in a very real sense, the tyranny of the state is being replaced for the moment by the tyranny of the market, even though, of course, in the long run, the hope is the market will open the way to freedom.
You were last in Russia just a couple of weeks ago. What's different now, just walking down the streets, walking into shops? Now that it's not a communist society anymore, what are the visible signs of difference that you see?
Well, when I was there in January, I was there the day they raised prices or they allowed prices to rise as part of the economic reforms they're carrying out. The prices went up, but at that point there was little, if anything, to buy in the stores. Food stores were empty. You'd see these shelves upon shelves and nothing in them. It was like a morgue, as one of my Russian friends said. This time, there were products in the stores. There was milk, there was cottage cheese, there were vegetables, there were some fruits, there was even an occasional scrawny chicken. There was some meat. but the prices are extraordinarily high. Now, that's in a way the theory. The high prices were supposed to produce the goods. People who'd been hoarding, factories, processing plants that had been hoarding, were supposed to now deliver to the market in order to sell their goods at higher prices. But I asked myself the question, what for Russians who couldn't afford what was in the stores, and this is, I think, the majority of the population, what was worse, to enter a store and find nothing, or to enter a store and find it full, but with things that you can't afford to buy? The reforms are impoverishing people. I heard on Soviet or Russian television when I was there the following figure, that the poverty level for a family of four is now considered to be below an income of 1,500 rubles a month. And the average wage in the country is about 850 rubles a month. An average pension is about 400 rubles a month. The result of all of this is that something like 80 to 90% of the population lives below the poverty line. This is what strikes you. And it strikes you, I think, even more when you walk down the streets. And in several places in Moscow, as you walk for blocks, you walk between two long lines of people who are standing there on either side. It's like a column. You walk between them. And they're standing there silently, holding out their hands, trying to sell things. When the people are young and what they're trying to sell is some glitzy Western product, you have a feeling that there's energy in the air, that energy's begun flowing and that people have come out of their houses to start trying to buy and sell, and that this is a good sign. But the bulk of these people are old people, and they're dressed in threadbare clothes, and they have hangdog looks on their face, and what they're holding out to sell is the one item of value that they've managed to collect in their entire life. You know, a crystal goblet, or a pair of shoes. And you have this terrible, sad feeling that they're not going to sell it. They're going to come back tomorrow. It's going to go on. And someday, although one is told there's no starvation, some sad day they're going to starve or they're going to die. The point is that although these economic reforms that they're carrying out may make sense, and the IMF obviously thinks they do, and the West obviously thinks they do, they may make economic sense, but politically and socially they are explosive, they are destructive, and they are creating a constituency against not only the market, but also against democracy. And that constituency includes, I discovered to my horror, not only the Neanderthal right, the former Soviet patriots and the anti-Semitic Russian extremists, but good people, progressive, liberal, democratic people are equally appalled.
There is now a proposed aid package for the Soviet Union. Seven nations, including the United States, would be giving $24 billion in aid to the former Soviet republics, the bulk of the money going to Russia. Over $4 billion would be coming from the United States. Do you think that this aid package would help the kind of poverty that you're describing in Russia?
Well, I hope it will help. I think if the money gets channeled to the people in need, it will help. There's been a lot of talk in the West about how the money goes astray, but that doesn't even seem to me to be the main problem. The main problem is that I think no amount of money, even big money on this scale, can solve their problem. No amount of money can turn people who believe in their bones that buying and selling is somehow corrupt, can turn them into believers in a free market. And even the generosity of the West, which is clearly on display here, has another side to it in the eyes of Russian beholders. These are people who are desperate, and they are dependent on us. And with that desperation and dependence comes a kind of touchy defensiveness. There is a latent anti-Westernism, certainly on the part of former communist bureaucrats and Russia firsters. And it comes out at the thought that the West is is helping them, oddly enough. I felt this in the archives when I pushed them in my negotiations in the archives to declassify more and better materials and to do it faster. They would get very heated up about the fact that our partnership with them gave us no right to put the pressure on them in this way.
You were describing before about how there are these lines of people selling things in the streets. In Russia, did you buy anything on this last trip to Russia?
I didn't buy much, partly because I'm generally not a buyer, but also because I was too busy running from one archive to another. The one thing I did buy was I bought two of these political matryoshkas. You know, the non-political matryoshka is the wooden doll of the old the grandmother, their old peasant grandmother, and it opens up, and there's another one inside, and that opens up, and there's another one.
Yeah.
They now sell them with the big doll is Yeltsin. He opens up, and there's Gorbo, and then he opens up, and on you go, not only all the way to Lenin, which is what I expected, but the tiniest doll of all is Nicholas II, the last Tsar. So the dolls begin and end with the leaders of Russia, and all the leaders of the Soviet Union turn out to be has-beens inside.
Well, William Taubman, thank you very much for talking with us.
You're most welcome.
William Taubman is a professor of political science at Amherst College. We recorded our interview yesterday. In the interim, there's been some reshuffling in the Russian government. Yegor Gaidar, the chief architect of the free market reforms, will no longer be finance minister. He will continue as deputy prime minister in charge of overall economic policy. Taubman told us today how he interprets this news, although the Russian economic policy is winning approval in the international economic community, it's losing steam at home. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.